In some instances, the individual has gone directly to the organization and resigned, as making a statement that he is no longer in favor of it. But if the organization is religious and he has taken certain sacramental obligations, the question is, can he resign from his vows? That is a very much more difficult one. It is done. It has been done frequently. But what is the result upon the person? Is this individual damaging himself? Is his emancipation of such a nature that he is able to realize that he was mistaken in his previous allegiance? Is he able to sense that perhaps he is breaking an obligation which was taken in terms of a belief that is not true? Even presuming this to be so, can he break an obligation that he has taken to himself? This is a strong moral problem. There is no trite answer, because the individual has to live with himself. And out of the mystery of his own conscience must come finally that which he can do and that which he cannot. Now, in addition to the private opinion or the private conviction of the individual, the world has built up gradually a collective pattern of ethics. This collective pattern has been contributed to by nearly all of the surviving civilizations and many that have not survived. The great descent of man's concept of morality and ethics constitutes one of the most powerful of our psychological heritages. We have gradually built most of our morality around Scripture, most of our ethics around philosophy. Yet in this phase of the problem, they are essentially identical. The only difference being that while our ethical assumptions or our ethical convictions may be defended by a certain reasonableness, either logic or other instrument of philosophy, our moral or religious allegiances can be defended by faith only, or by the mysterious factor of intense realization, or intuition, or inspirational guidance. Therefore, morality rapidly moves toward the metaphysical, whereas ethics remains very largely in the realm of physics, a kind of metaphysical physics, but in a more material sense. Morality, therefore, can be traditional, and it can be highly personal. But we do have certain standards, and civilized nations must live within the general patterns of these standards. And where the individual diverges too far from the morality and ethics of his time, he is subject to censure. Now, this censure may take many forms, but it nearly always results in some misfortune, some difficulty or unpleasantness, which the offender must accept, and which may gradually work a hardship upon him. Within any structure of ethics, however, we also must continue to recognize the unethical person. We realize that any traditional form can come in violation with individual attitudes, and that therefore what we call crime, which is the violation of the laws of men, or sin, which is theologically a violation of the laws of God, that both of these exist and have existed from the dawn of time, and that actually in matters of both crime and sin there has been comparatively little progress. There has been a certain refinement, but these two values have not been advanced as rapidly as our skills or attitudes on other subjects. So that today, as far as our moral and ethical lives are concerned, we are making precisely the same mistakes as our most remote ancestors, the only difference being that we are making them in a rather more sophisticated manner. Perhaps this in itself is an indication of lost ground, because it is assumed that increasing intelligence should have given us greater control of our own conduct. Morality, then, as a practical subject, has to do with the individual gaining emotional control over conduct. Ethics with his gaining mental control over attitudes. Both of these have their very obvious and very practical expressions in human society. And nearly everyone who is interested in advancing himself, gaining a better attitude toward life, freeing himself from old fears and doubts and anxieties, and gaining a sense of integration in life and into the life of the universe, must try in some way or other to discover principles which will guide his ethical and moral convictions and at the same time not offend his intelligence. This is not always easy, but gradually systems of philosophy have accomplished this. We know that for the most part, the world's greatest heroes, those for whom we have the greatest admiration, regarding them as the noblest of human beings, have been outstanding examples of constructive morality and ethics. We know also that great systems of religion are in relative agreement as to what constitutes morality. Great systems of philosophy are in relative agreement as to what constitutes ethics. And even on the material plane of life, where ethics is most apt to be violated, the ethical structure of society holds ethics to be desirable, to be necessary, to be proper, and regrets the loss of ethical integrity, even though it does not support that integrity. So each person does have a reference frame, and this reference frame must be in terms of time and place. And the reference frame makes available to him the best ethics that the world has known. It makes available to him the highest concepts of morality which man has achieved. And it presents these truths, or these realities, or these concepts in the most persuasive and reasonable way, pointing out the proven dangers of transgressing these standards. The simplest attitude that we know of, perhaps, in ethics, is found in the recommendation or admonition of Jesus as to what constitutes the law and the prophets, namely that we shall love God and live honestly with our fellow men. This constitutes what might be termed natural morality and ethics. If we love a spiritual principle, we are again reminded of the words, "If you love me, keep my commandments." To love God is to live according to our conviction of what God requires. To claim to love, and at the same time to go contrary to this claim, is not only to subject us to inconsistency, it is going to subject us to conflict within ourselves, causing sickness. I believe we will demonstrate in the ages that lie ahead, somewhere along the line, that a very large part of sickness, for which we now give innumerable possible causes, actually arise, these various types of sickness, arise in man's inner conflict between his conviction and his conduct. If this could be completely cleared out within himself, it is quite likely that he would live longer and live more happily, have more energy and better health, inasmuch as all of his resources are involved in the subtle condemnation of himself, which he practices whether he admits it or not. And under pressure, nearly always, the lack of ethics, the lack of morality, will bring further hazards, which cause again further concern, until the individual collapses in the responsibilities of his own mistakes. So we think of ethics and morality not only as virtues of the spirit and of the mind, but necessary guides of conduct and action if we wish to have the maximum value out of the physical life that we live. So we can say now that morality for the individual is based upon a series of attitudes or a series of concepts which are developed rather broadly and deeply in Neoplatonism. Certain values have a common nature in the universe. The various manifestations of universal law give different expressions to an identical group of values, these values interpreting themselves in many, many ways. For example, one of the ways in which things which are reasonable manifest themselves may be termed orderly. A thing is orderly, in which the parts of itself are in proper relationships to each other. A thing is in order when there is no longer any disorder in it. And this lack of disorder actually means that there is no conflict in it, no disagreement in it, no asymmetry within the structure of that thing. So that which is termed orderly may also be termed reasonable. Because when we achieve an orderly state of the mind, we are reasonable. When we achieve a reasonable state of the virtues, we are moral. When we achieve a moral state in relation to certain specialized fields, such as, for example, the arts, we discover that morality and virtue suddenly manifest as beauty. Beauty is only another name for this same orderliness that we started out with. Beauty is everything in its proper relationship to everything else. Now, we may say that standards of beauty differ with various peoples, but this is true almost exclusively because of familiarity. We give a certain acceptance to things familiar. But at the same time, these familiar things must be acceptable to our standards of aesthetics and integrity. So virtue, beauty, goodness, love, faith, hope, all of these different terms more or less represent the manifestations of one principle in various areas of activity. And that which is beautiful is harmonious. That which is harmonious is ethical. Then we have a scientific sequences. We have scientific types of order, as we represent it in the magnificent universal geometry manifested in snowflakes. We say that a snowflake is a magnificent example of universal order. Because it is this, it is beautiful. Because of it being a representation of universal order, it must be good. Because that which is manifested according to its universal has to be good. It is when it is distorted away from its universal that it ceases to be good. So we are dealing with all kinds of patterns. We are dealing with musical harmonies. For the Greeks were very quick to point out that musical discords were immoral, and that the individual who permitted himself to be influenced by them would destroy part of his own integration. Now, whether they are fashionable, whether everybody likes them, whether they give a certain unreasonable stimulation to jaded nerves, the fact remains that discords are not good. And that which is not good does not produce good. And that which is not good, when brought into contact with the consciousness of the individual, hurts that individual. And if this not good remains too frequently as an oppression upon the spirit of the individual, his own moral nature is injured as a result. We may say the same thing of various color harmonies. An asymmetrical work of art is not good. That by which by its nature is without morality, by its implication is without ethics, by its structure is without order, and by its color or form is without harmony. This thing is not good. Now we have no longer the Pythagorean attitude that inanimate things can influence us. Yet we know they do, regardless of whether we admit it or not. We know that the environment in which we live may be inanimate, but it is an influencing factor. We know that our profession is not a living entity, yet it will change our character. And we must also always point out that we can be and are constantly under the pressure of various abnormal situations. So in our ethics, we have to realize that there is ethical and non-ethical art. This brings us to another point. Can we use three terms here? Can we say ethical, unethical, non-ethical? We have used this conveniently in recent years in various ways. We say moral, immoral, and amoral. We use various terms to indicate a neutrality between the extremes, the purpose of this neutrality being to deprive the subject discussed of any value, assuming that it can be neutral, that we can say that a thing has neither good nor bad meaning, therefore that it has no meaning. But we are not in nature able to demonstrate that anything that exists has no meaning. We have no way of demonstrating that any situation, condition, or quality that arises can be neutral, even though we may try to make it so. Everything must finally verge toward the good or the bad. It cannot be completely in equilibrium. We're reminded again of the good words of the Holy Book, namely that which is neither hot nor cold, the Lord speweth out of his mouth. And this is the problem of all this so-called equilibrium situation, a situation in which the individual feels free to express himself in any way that he wishes to because he does not put a directive upon that expression. He doesn't have to. The expression itself has to be direct. Therefore, he must take responsibility for the directive, regardless of whether he is willing to assume that responsibility or not. He cannot say, as some parents do, we can lie among ourselves, but the children must tell the truth. He cannot say this. He cannot say that he is using a non-directive line because he is advising the children not to lie. He cannot escape the fact that whatever attitude he takes has a directive. And in this world there is no person so humble or so ignorant or so perverse that he does not have at least two disciples in the course of living. someone is going to copy him. Someone is going to use him as a standard, whether he is high or low on the level of human affairs. So we cannot avoid the idea of the final ethical and moral results of conduct. Therefore, we must dismiss also the amoral, non-ethical universe which we have been trying so desperately to maintain. There is not one single thing in nature that does not affect any creature that is conscious of that thing. We may assume there are forces or situations that do not affect us because we do not know of their existence. They may affect us subjectively, however. Of this we are not sure. But one thing we do know is that the sunrise and the sunset, the full moon and the new moon, the rising and setting of the stars, the sounds of both man and nature, the architecture around us, the various processes and policies which we create, the clothing we wear, the food we eat, the attitudes we hold, the attitudes that others hold to us, all of these things and an infinite diversity of other things, all affect us. All affecting us in terms of strengthening morality and ethics or tearing down morality and ethics, causing the individual to verge toward the good or away from the good. And life as a total experience is made up of these innumerable pressures, which in some way must come into a summary. They must finally form one compound, and this compound then becomes, we may say, the symbol of the total result of living. We have advanced a little by innumerable and diverse courses, or we have retarded ourselves a little by one group of factors or another. But every individual coming out of this life at the end of an embodiment leaves this world a little better or a little worse than he enters it. No one leaves in a completely neutral condition. No one takes out precisely what he brought in and no more and no less, because he cannot survive over a period of years without in some way being affected. Thus, we know that morality and ethics constitute continuous challenges to our integrity and to our values. And we then try to find simple ways of applying some of these challenges to the obvious associations of daily living. The individual, as Plotinus points out in his essay on the beautiful, requires various types of nutrition to support his life. Plato, again, in the Banquet of Olympiodorus, gives us the same general thinking. Man exists only because of nutrition. His entire manifestation is due to the fact that there is enough fuel provided to enable him to continue in various functions. This fuel is not all of one kind, any more than the fuel used in a very elaborate machine may be all of one kind, as in a combustion motor where at least two or three kinds of ingredients or fuels or materials are necessary to maintain the efficiency of the device. Each person, therefore, as Plotinus points out, must receive nutrition. He receives it in many, many ways. He receives it from the sun and the moon and the stars and the earth beneath his feet. He receives the magnetic currents of nature, which are invisible to him, but which must certainly be nutritional to certain invisible parts of his own composition. He lives in a universe of energies to which he responds in varying degrees according to his nature and constitution. In addition to these factors, he has three obvious forms of nutrition necessary to the maintenance of his physical existence, not as a body, but as a person in a body. In other words, the personality, the character, the temperament, the compound thing we call the individual in the material world, must have three basic types of nutrition. He must have physical food. If this physical food is diluted, polluted, or corrupted, he will be sick and or die. If this food is not available, he will starve. If this food is not of proper quality or is inordinately indulged in, he will ultimately destroy himself. Therefore, immoderation in all things is destruction. He must therefore have proper food of a proper kind, under proper conditions, and in proper amounts. This food must be good food. By good food, we come into a moral question now. It must be honorably produced, honorably prepared. There must be no adulteration or chemicalization or evasion of good or pure food and drug laws. Anything that contaminates the food contaminates the body and injures it. And we are rather careful in this because we do not, any of us, particularly want to die of ptomaine poisoning. We do the best we can and grumble at the fact there is so little we can do in comparison to what we believe would be an ideal diet. The second thing that we have to have, as Plotinus tells us, is nutrition for other parts of the life. What food is to the body, beauty is to the psychic integration. The individual must receive a continuous nutrition of harmony, beauty, order, morality, and symmetry. He must be exposed continuously to the reaffirming within himself, or the restoring within himself, of the supply of idealism for which the soul is in continuous need. If the soul receives contaminated food, it sickens. If the food is too bad, the soul, as far as its function for man is concerned, may be said to die, although it does not actually perish. But it is sickened unto death. And any food which destroys the harmony of the soul destroys man's ability to be a well-organized, well-ordered, happily adjusted human being. So every day, just as man takes in food, so must he likewise take in beauty. Now, the Chinese have a very interesting policy about this, which, while it is not necessary to our thinking entirely, shows that even 3,000 and 4,000 years ago, the Chinese, like the Greeks, were aware of this. And they tried to work it out in a very simple matter of food symbolism itself. The Chinese say that a meal placed in front of you must be nutritious. That is, it must be composed of food that is well prepared, nourishing, properly grown, and properly ripened, and properly diversified to provide a balanced ration. Now, this is all utility, and the result could be a kind of an emaciated-looking hash of some nature might have everything in it, but it would not be especially palatable. But the Chinese says that no matter how nutritious the food is, if it is not beautiful to the eyes, it is fake. The individual must find beauty in the food. He must look at the plate and he must say, "This is a lovely meal. This is a magnificent bit of still life. This is something that I enjoy looking at. And because I enjoy looking at it, I'm going to digest it better. The third thing, he says, I am now going to take a bite of this food. My sense of taste must be pleased. The food I eat must be an adventure of some nature that is delightful. The food must have quality. It must have texture. Some of it must be crisp. Some of it must be soft. Some of it must be smooth. Some might require a certain amount of condiment. Others, we want only the natural flavor without anything added. Flavor must be protected. To the Chinese, the most dismal thing in the whole world is overcooked food, cooked into a stew in which there is nothing left. The next thing that the Chinese like in connection with it is that it must smell good. It must be attractive to the sense perceptions. And they even go so far as to have all kinds of food products that sound good. You can hear the crisp and the crackle and the snapple of these foods and all these things. The Chinese says that when your five senses are equally pleased, the meal is well prepared, the food is nutritious, the environment is good, that there is no greater way of ensuring health, and that there is no way in which an individual can dig his grave more definitely and more distinctly than by shoveling in a mass of material which neither pleases him nor delights his soul, and for all he knows may not even nourish his body. So the Chinese tries to get at it all in the meal. But he does add conversation. He does add a pleasant atmosphere. He does point out that the service is good. It helps to make this whole thing an experience of the soul, which is fulfilling of artistry and all these things. Now, this can be done very simply. It doesn't have to be as elaborate as the Chinese thing. But the Chinese is right when he says, you must plan it, you must eat it thoughtfully, you must enjoy it. It must be important, or ultimately it will do you no good. In the Greek theory, after you got to the point of beauty, where every day the soul must be fed with art, with good music, with literature, with kindly associations with nature, a few moments in the garden, a view out over the ocean, to look at a beautiful picture, to read a beautiful poem, to meditate upon some kindly and learned work, or to find some great grace and beauty in the words of the saint and the sage and the savior. These are the experiences of every day. If we do not have them, something dries up in us, something becomes deformed, distorted, until we are no longer beautiful people. And then, as the Greeks pointed out, the mind must also be there. To feed the mind with prejudice is like feeding the body with tainted food. It is going to sicken the mind. To feed the mind gossip is like feeding it food which has no nutritional value. Nothing is good is going to come out of it, only waste and residue that is of no value. To feed the mind a superficial thing is to try to live in the kind of a world in which we would feed the body nothing but French pastry and hope it would survive. There has to be solid mental food. Food of thought, food of reflection, food that comes from the rational consideration of the values and problems of life, the food of philosophy, the food of science, the food of education. These things have to be provided. And if the personality with its three major parts is not so sustained by a balanced nutrition, it becomes sick. And Socrates points out that the first sickness that the soul exhibits is the deterioration of its morality and ethics. Just as surely as the body begins to function badly, if its nutrition is in some way destroyed or perverted, so man, deprived of the total diet necessary to his integrity, is injured first in the most subtle parts of himself. The body may go on because he may be stuffing it with enough calories to hold it up, or he may be taking enough supplementary vitamins to get by on. But you can't do this. You can feed the emotion sophistications, which might seem like vitamins. You can feed the mind systems of brittle thinking, which might seem to be stimulants. But at the same time, the mind, unless it is given the food upon which mind grows naturally, and the emotions, unless they are given the nutrition which helps emotions to mature, deepen, and enrich, unless these values are provided, the individual begins to deteriorate from the top down. He deteriorates first in the compromising of his ethics. He deteriorates in his indifference to learning. This gradually results in antisocial attitudes of all kinds, the loss of respect for himself and for others, and the gradual development of an excessive criticism that is not controllable. If his aesthetics or his moral life is not enriched, it is impoverished. And the individual who has a rich, deep understanding of harmony will not do things which are discordant, asymmetrical, or emotionally wrong. But where he has no education, no culture, no insight into value, he has no basis for the recognition of true value in beauty, in friendship, in love, or in any other subtle emotional relationship which must depend upon the intuitive power of the emotions to recognize the beautiful and the good. If he has this inner nutrition, he will not become a delinquent. But if this nutrition is lacking within himself, he will. Confucius gives us this formula so wonderfully. He points out that everyone says to young people or to older people, be good, do what is right. This you must do, this you must not do. And the scriptures of the world are burdened with thou shalt not from the beginning to the end. But this is not the answer. It is like telling the child not to eat what it wants. The answer does not lie in this building of high banks and barriers against conduct. The decision, the real solution lies in building within the individual a total concept of integrity. So Confucius said, if you want a man to be honest in his dealings, teach him music. It will change him inside himself. If you want him to be a good husband, teach him poetry. If you want him to be a kindly father, teach him philosophy. If you want him to be a good workman, give him religious insight. Don't go after the detail that you want him to do, but make him a totally bigger person inside. And if you do this, he will be a totally better person on the outside. You cannot prevent this modification of his own life. So if we want to make these changes, which we realize would be a little helpful now and then, if we want more courage, we must cultivate these values. Now, as most philosophy has demonstrated, these values are corrective of the excesses against which they have been properly contrived or built up. The individual, for example, who is selfish, has lost symmetry of soul. If he gains beauty of soul through the enrichment of his emotional experience on all reasonable levels, particularly in aesthetics, this individual, as his appreciation grows for that which is truly beautiful, inevitably becomes less selfish. The individual who has discovered great beauty is like the Chinese, who, having discovered the infinite wonder of Tao, has very few desires as far as possessions go. He is not controlling himself. He is not going without because he must decide between virtue and vice. But he suddenly discovers in the cultivation of beauty that selfishness is simply foolish. That the only things he can ever really own are the things which are in his own consciousness and which can never be taken from him. So as before he might have been trying to gather up a little comfort from the world, he goes out and sits quietly under a tree and shares the eternal comfort of the universe. All changes within the individual therefore lessen negative intensities. And as he grows in morality and ethics, by the quiet encouragement of these things, he becomes a totally better person. And that is one of the reasons why, for so many years, we have been doing everything possible to interest people in music, in art, in fine things outside of religion and philosophy on which their minds have become so set. They are trying so hard to be good and to be wise that they do not realize that this beauty that they need and this wisdom that they desire will grow within themselves by the almost effortless effort that is Taoism itself. The simple, increasing love of beauty, the recognition of nobility, the quiet enjoyment of gentle learning, these things are the medicines and the foods by which the inner life of man matures and perfects itself. The man who loves beauty does not need to fear death. He may not be able to take his pictures and his paintings and his etchings with him, but he will take with him the power to enjoy universal beauty. The man who loves music may not be able to take the old violin with him, but he will be able to be quiet wherever he is in space and hear the music of the fields. So all these great values enrich the inner life, and in so doing, confer upon man the benefits of an immortal existence that will be eternally beautiful. In this thinking and in this way, we can get around, behind, and under the more formal structure of logic and ethics and come to the realization of this important reality of the natural ethic, the natural logic, through the simple acceptance of which we grow as we were intended to grow. Not by great pain. The lily of the field does not grow in pain. It grows in fulfillment. It grows because growth is its natural quality. Man has this same natural quality. And it is true, as the king of Israel said, looking upon the lily, that Solomon in all his glory is not arrayed like one of these. Actually, the growth of things protects these things. They do not suffer till they pause in their own growth. They do not come into pain until they resist beauty, resist truth, and resist wisdom. And when we understand that, we will have a solid ground for a great constructive approach to ethical and logical philosophy. Well, our time is up, so we'll see you next week.